That's Misha Nichnas Adar. As we enter the second month of Adar, the month of Purim, we try to add joy into the world. Misha Nichnas Adar, Adar Marbim Besimcha. We add more joy into the world. And we don't just wait for it to come, but we proactively do it by preparing food for those in poverty, by preparing food gifts for friends and community members, by preparing meals. So I wish everyone a joyful Adar. We just had a big event here this morning, and almost the entire local people, members of the class, were here. Steve and Gary and Cheryl and a bunch of others. So they're not going to be in Zoom, so it's going to be a small group of us here today. But we will start with a poll question as usual about Martha Nussbaum. And let's see what we have here. On shame, the emotion of shame is purely destructive, or the emotion of shame can be productive. What do you think here? The emotion of shame is purely destructive, or the emotion of shame can be productive? Okay, 100%. The emotion of shame can be productive. Very interesting. Okay, friends, Martha Nussbaum, and at some point we'll play a little interview with her and me, but really just listening to her. Should the law care about our feelings? It's kind of a funny question. How do emotions impact individual behaviors? And how does that translate into the function of systems? Hailed by some as one of the most important philosophers in modernity, and certainly one of the most important woman thinkers of our time, Dr. Martha Nussbaum's work in philosophy has engaged significantly with the ancient Greeks, political philosophy, feminism, classics, existentialism, and ideas about justice. Unsurprisingly, she's the Ernst Freund Distinguished Service Professor of Law and Ethics at the University of Chicago's School of Law, while also holding a joint appointment in the Department of Philosophy, as well as associate faculty roles in classics, political science, and the Divinity School. Originally, Nussbaum studied theater before pursuing graduate work in philosophy, receiving her master's and PhD from Harvard. She has since written 24 books and received the Kyoto Prize, Berggruen Prize, Balzan Prize, and more than 60 honorary doctorates from universities around the world. Oh, by the way, the guy there in the red vest is Kwame Appiah, who is going to be our 45th philosopher in this series, our last one next week, the fellow there with the in the red vest. Also of note, while Dr. Nussbaum was born in 1947 to a Protestant family in New York City, she converted to Judaism and is now an active member of KAM Israel's congregation and choir in Chicago. And I'm grateful for her influence on and participation in my own life. Notably, a talk she gave in 2004 is what prompted me personally to give up meat, based on a talk she gave. And I was privileged to conduct a video interview with her a couple of years ago. We're now going to hear a few minutes of her, just to get a sense of what she looks like and sounds like, and a few of her words on how her own Jewish journey has influenced her philosophy.
So on these points in particular, or other dimensions of your philosophy work, is there a point or two in which you might point to of how Jewish texts may have contributed, Jewish values may have contributed towards your thinking?
Well, you know, when I'm in synagogue, first of all, it's usually as a member of the choir, and our great cantor, David Berger, always is inspiring me to think more deeply about all the emotions in my life and about grief. In fact, this evening, there's going to be a stream service celebrating Kristallnacht, because he's an expert in the music. So music reaches me very deeply. And the recovery of some of the great Jewish music of Europe, which is his specialty, has been very important to me because I am an amateur singer and know classical music well. And so to have that musical tradition alive for me does something for me. And you know, maybe you'll say that's not so particularly Jewish, but of course it is the the Jewishness of it, the marriage of Jewish texts with the music of Europe that I have always known from childhood and care about. But I also think one concept that I think about constantly is the concept of tikkun olam, because I think this is really what we're dealing with here. We've broken the world. We are living in a way that does violence, not only to the natural environment, but to every single kind of animal. If you think of what goes on in a factory farm, the slaughterhouse, but also if you think about how whales in the wilds of the ocean are being killed now by swallowing gallons of plastic that we've put into the seas, that is a broken world. So I do think that the Jewish concept of tikkun olam helps us think what it would be to work toward a world where instead of just dominating the seas, the air, and the land, we work in harmony with others to restore all of those areas of the world.
Wow, wow.
Well, that's a great place to pause. Perfect. Dr. Nussbaum, while continuing to contribute throughout the breadth of the world of philosophy with an emphasis on ethics, is perhaps best known for her work with what is called neo-Aristotelian capabilities approach. Rather than emphasize abstract rights, it instead focuses on the capabilities that are unique to being human by asking the question, what are people actually able to do and to be? This approach revises common understandings of freedom to reflect the quality of possibilities an individual has. Can someone who technically has the freedom of acquiring food reasonably act on that choice? If she does act on that choice, can she choose to do so in a way that leaves her more substantially nourished, perhaps even more morally nourished, or even simply nourished in a way that makes her happier? If she can't make a meaningful choice in this regard, what mechanisms does she have at her disposal to move herself into a position of choice in the matter, if she's interested in one? Nussbaum defines 10 capabilities that are required for human life to be, quote, not so impoverished that it is not worthy of the dignity of a human being. These are broad categories that include life, bodily health, bodily integrity, senses, imagination, and thought, emotion, practical reason, filiation, the choice to meaningfully interact with other species when it's mutually agreeable, play, and control over one's environment. While this approach in and of itself can feel quite revelatory to how we might evaluate if human rights are flourishing or not, what's even more philosophically astounding is her application of this thought to non-human animals. Rejecting anthropocentric lines of animal defense that we should focus on protecting animals who are like us in terms of intelligence, or more utilitarian notions that we should at least be more sensitive to the lives of animals who we glean some sort of value from, she instead views each animal as an end, insisting that we should protect animals for what they are in and of themselves. Her defense of animal rights is an extension of the capabilities approach she applies to humans. Just as humans have specific capabilities that enable their lives to flourish, so too the same can be determined for animals. With regards to animals that have historically had a great deal of human interaction, opportunities for intervention can be quite nuanced, including everything from personal diet to legislation. While she suggests that with wildlife, our best angle for support is environmental stewardship. Much of Nussbaum's philosophical work has revolved around questions of emotion and law, particularly the roles that human emotions, such as shame, and disgust. While disgust may be a powerful emotion, he cautions that it's often rooted in irrational concerns. He says in her 2004 work, Hiding from Humanity, disgust is very different from anger in that its thought content is typically unreasonable, embodying magical ideas of contamination and impossible aspirations to purity, immortality, and non-animality that are just not in line with human life as we know it. That does not mean that disgust did not play a valuable role in our evolution. Very likely it did. Nor does it mean that it does not play a useful function in our current daily lives. Very likely it does. Perhaps even the function of hiding from us problematic aspects of our humanity is useful. Perhaps we cannot easily live with too much vivid awareness of the fact that we are made of sticky and oozy substances that will all too soon decay. She goes on to argue that even with the potential usefulness of feelings of disgust, we should reject it as a basis for lawmaking, particularly because it has been used throughout history to exclude and marginalize groups or people who come to embody the dominant group's fear and loathing of its own animality and mortality. Throughout the corpus of her writings, she focuses on how notions of disgust have been used to oppress women, Jews, and homosexuals. In her 2010 book, From Disgust to Humanity, she specifically analyzes the politics of disgust with reference to legislation against homosexual marriage, relationships, and acts. Ultimately, she argues that in the realm of political thought, societies are better and more ethically served by functioning in line with the harm principle forwarded by John Stuart Mill, as opposed to seeking to codify feelings. While rabbinic literature is filled with emotions that interact with texts and religious laws in a variety of ways, the Torah itself does not always clarify the role of human emotion in particular scenarios. While Nussbaum doesn't see the value of disgust within law, here we will see a case in the Torah where disgust can potentially play a morally constructive role. The case of the Eshet Yifat Toar, the beautiful captive woman, is found in the 21st chapter of Deuteronomy, following the laws of Egla Arufa, the process of which city elders atone for the death of a person whose body is found beyond their boundaries. The Torah introduces circumstances of war that were common historically and unfortunately are not unheard of in modern conflicts. A Jewish man in the hormonal and emotional milieu of military victory sees an enemy woman, finds her beautiful, and abducts her. The Torah does not condone his actions, but stipulates that if he is to do this, he must then bring her into his home, drop her hair, pare her nails, and discard her captive's garb. He must then allow her to observe a full month of mourning for her parents. Only after this is the soldier permitted to have her as a wife in every sense. If, following all of this, he rejects her, he must let her go free, entirely free, rather than selling her as a slave. Now, I recommend, if you want to study this passage in full, if you have not before, to look at Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 10 to 14. Part of this naturally might feel or will feel barbaric to us as 21st century people who, you know, don't relate to being soldiers in war. Most of us don't relate to, don't relate to really any of this. Can't imagine wanting to stay in the home of someone who's taken us captive. And yet we can ask, what is the Torah trying to achieve here that we can learn from potentially? Many traditional commentaries are firm in the assertion that the Torah is trying to prevent intermarriage. This woman is clearly an idol worshiper, and while the soldier might think that he is in control, he will use her charms to subvert his spiritual quest. Rashi goes so far as to say that the captive's garb is actually a seductive outfit she wore into battle for the purpose of luring an enemy soldier astray. Much of the interpretation of this text is meant to evoke feelings of disgust. Whether this process is imagined as a way to make, quote unquote, make the woman physically repulsive to the man so he won't want to marry her, or to help him see that she is spiritually disgusted. Rabbi Ari Mermelstein analyzes how disgust is given form in the Midrashic tradition surrounding Eshet Yifat Toar, pairing her to a gourd, a piece of dead meat or rotten food. The gourd metaphor might fall a little flat in a world where people set pumpkins on their steps as a seasonal decoration, But it's nonetheless a deeply dehumanizing image. But this is all rabbinic conjecture. The Torah tells us that the man feels desire for her when he first captures the beautiful woman. But the only emotions we see after belong to her. For a full month, she is in full-fledged avelut in the house of her captor, and she mourns and grieves the loss of her family. Even though she's been kidnapped, a violation of any number of her rights by modern standards, the Torah forces her captor to leave her what Nussbaum refers to as the capabilities of emotion, grief being one of the most profound among them. Quote, when we love people, she says, often there's loss, and the grief that acknowledges that loss, I think, is a way of acknowledging the depth and importance of that love. Grief is something we typically share only in our most intimate relationships. It can be ugly, uncontrollable crying, running out of things to blow one's nose and dry one's eyes on, and occasionally some horrific wailing. And we might imagine that a woman who has been taken away from her people by force, who certainly must think that her loved ones are dead, has grief that goes to the marrow. And the captor must endure this, must honor this, must provide space for this strange woman as she mourns in his home the very enemies that he sought to defeat. Perhaps he will see her as disgusting in all of this, for it is often the case that we find others' grief to be unnerving. Even more so, perhaps he will find himself disgusting in realizing the impact of his actions in warfare and in seeing that even idolaters are human. The Torah takes this woman, who is painted as a moral enemy, and nonetheless defends some portion of her bodily integrity and her human dignity against the man's impulses. If the prescription is not morally generative for the imagined soldier, then it is certainly has the potential to be for us, as we consider the reality that our whims and desires do not dictate rights or realities in the religious imagination. We are beholden to the other. The Torah will not fully legitimate our desire to crush the enemy and see them as inhuman. Therefore, it forces us to confront the pain and grief of the other. As we see in this case, and surely in many others from our own lives, trying to develop rules around anything related to the subjectivities of emotions is difficult. Jewish law moves around this with a general orientation towards translating mitzvot that appear to be about emotions into discrete actions. We have developed and codified ways of expressing love, joy, and grief, particular to weddings, holidays, and the loss of different family members. In contrast to the disgust legislation that Nussbaum focuses on, we often see an individual's negative emotion, such as those associated with mourning, turned into an opportunity for the community to witness and support the aggrieved. It's a form of human love, says Nussbaum, to accept our complicated, messy humanity and not run away from it. Torah has mechanisms for helping us to do this even when it's difficult. How might our own emotions and impulses be a source for personal behaviors that limit the dignity, capabilities, or rights of others? How is that politicized? How do we stop individual disgust from being transformed into fears of social contagion? Check out this chart. If you can't see it, you're on the podcast. We're looking at comfortable emotions as it looks towards being playful, confident, loved, happy. Uncomfortable emotions as it looks to being sad, scared, angry, embarrassed. And the range of human emotions we feel throughout the day. Guilty, excluded, ashamed, annoyed, jealous, bored, overwhelmed, powerless, anxious, disappointed, hurt, and lonely. We will feel all of those today. And then to the positive side, caring, grateful, excited, respected, valued, accepted, brave, hopeful, powerful, creative, curious, affectionate. We will feel all of those today. And how much of those should play into legislation or not? Jewish law, American law, and the like. How is all this politicized? How do we stop individual disgust from being transformed into fears of social contagion? How do we, whether guided by Torah or our own sense, define the humanity in people we might at first find in some way disgusting? How do we challenge ourselves to focus on the dignity of the other rather than on our own discomfort? What strategies do we have for recognizing the disgust people feel about abortion, homosexuality, transphobia, public breastfeeding, menstruation, women's sexuality, the elderly, visibly disabled people, and various other demographics, ideas, and actions that people often feel disgust around? How do we help people move past those feelings into recognition of the shared humanity? We can reflect based on Nussbaum upon how a capabilities approach might help us reorient our moral and political debates. We can also consider how much we have to take our emotions seriously in our legal and moral considerations. Just on that last point of disgust, there's this video that I can't get out of my head since I saw it a few days ago of the crazy, wicked Ayatollahs in Iran and how they're limiting women's freedoms. And in particular, this Ayatollah who's walking in a hospital where women are giving birth, and he sees a woman breastfeeding in the hospital where she gave birth. Breastfeeding. Like nursing a baby where she in the hospital she gave birth. And the Ayatollah is there to take a picture of her to show how inappropriate it is that in some way it's public that she's breastfeeding, and so that they will arrest her, take her baby, and then they close the clinic. They close the clinic for allowing these women to nurse in some way that might be deemed public. I mean, insane. And then you have insane people who want to defend Iran and Hamas, right? People who literally want to strip every woman's rights, every LGBTQ right, in the name of kind of progressive ideology. I stand with Hamas. I stand with the Ayatollahs, the people who are fighting Israel. And part of that fundamentalistic Islam, which can be found in fundamentalism of all other sorts as well. There's also people who think that, you know, women should be able to nurse in synagogues, you know, to be sure. To be clear, they're not looking to kill those women or close clinics. Like, it's very different degrees of fundamentalism. But based on their notion of disgust and the role of women, they are literally killing women over these kinds of things. And our eyes should be wide open around those kinds of things. And what happens when those emotions get codified into law and in abusive power systems of tyranny, and aware of that. So on the one hand, it sounds amazing. Emotions in law, what are we wrong? You can't take emotions out of law. But Nussbaum, interesting enough, thinks we need to think very carefully and cautiously about the role of emotions in law. And one of her many examples here having to be with disgust and what happens in laws when disgust, we allow disgust to be codified. Okay, friends, we talked about Nussbaum's neo-Aristotelian capabilities approach, her connection to environmentalism and to animal rights, how her animal rights approach is linked to a human rights approach. We didn't go so much into her many, many works on justice, which are very complicated and are just far beyond the simplistic notions of justice that are often thrown around in society today. And then we looked a little bit of her intersection between moral philosophy and being a scholar of law as well. And maybe you know more about Nussbaum in other realms as well. We also listened to a video of her on her interest in singing in the choir, her interest in Tikkun Olam, and how her Jewish identity as someone who converted some, you know, not so long ago when her first husband was Jewish as well, and how that has, you know, impact her thought as well. And again, this she has been claimed by some as one of the most important philosophers alive today. So, okay, friends, I'd love to hear from you on some things. Hey, Gary.
Okay, long time no see, Rabbi.
Yeah,
I was listening on the drive home from the meeting this morning till now, so I think I got most of it till I got home. I a couple of things I just wanted to address is her concept of Tikkun Olam, and I found that interesting because I have always put Tikkun Olam in a little more definitive terms for me anyway, is that you can't have shalom or peace if you or the world is in pieces, P-I-E-C-E-S. And I think that it's some of what we've talked about through this whole course with having inner peace and what have you. I think it's a wonderful concept in Judaism that we, not only do we heal ourselves, we have to help heal the world. And kind of what you just finished up on, do we always have to put, do we have to put everything into law? Can we not teach about human respect and inclusiveness and what have you? Why do we always have to legislate? So, I mean, if we look back into the ancient world, the Torah says these are the things we should do. I don't know if they're actually written laws in the civilization in those days, but, you know, and I know the Talmud discusses those, but again, I don't, maybe you could have some input in that. And the last thing I'll just put in, I think exposure when you're as a child or as an adult with the things that you are uncomfortable with makes a big difference how you look into the world and how you move forward. I'm very grateful to my parents that exposed my brothers and myself to a lot of things that even many people today are still uncomfortable with. You know, I grew up during the polio era. My mother's always take us to a polio hospital in Southern California to visit the kids and the adults in iron lungs. I mean, nothing more scary than a kid to walk in these clinics and see iron lungs. They should take us to Shiva minions and funerals, understand what it was like to be in grief. We went to vet. My father was a vet, so we went to veterans hospitals and saw a vet. So I think a lot has to do with exposure, and that teaches the next generation. And we shouldn't be scared to expose ourselves to things we are uncomfortable with, because that then makes us comfortable. And I'll leave it.
Yeah. Okay. Very nice. That exposure comment is very helpful. And I would add to that list of many other things. Dying. Sometimes we hide away dying. It's one of these taboo subjects because we've never exposed ourselves or our children to what that looks like. And so many other issues like that, or wounds, or pain. When I was in the airport a few days ago, and there were these two men kissing at the baggage claim, and I could see so many people staring at them. Some just because, you know, kissing in public was something they're uncomfortable with, but some because I could tell from how they're watching, like they've literally never seen men kiss each other before. And so many other things like this. And then Jews, right? Some people have never been exposed to Jews. Like, the number of people in the world who would still be uncomfortable with, encountering a Jew. And so many other things. I mean, I, as a boy, knew nothing about menstruation. I didn't have a sister. My mother never told me about it. Obviously, the girls at school didn't tell me about it. I can't even imagine how late it was that I even like heard about this crazy idea that what's going on? And so there's so many things like this that, that we're just not exposed to. And so we generate kind of a disgust orientation around it. And that doesn't mean that there aren't things in the world we should be disgusted by. There are things I think we should feel morally disgusted by. And so how do we balance, exposure with also, cultivating our own kind of judgments of what we think is appropriate behavior or not? For example, I would be disgusted if I saw a 70-year-old man deeply kissing a 14-year-old girl, right? I would be disgusted, and I think I would be appropriately disgusted, right? Because she's a minor, and that's taking advantage of a minor. And I can imagine someone else being like, hey, it's consensual and free love. People should be able to kiss whatever they want. And I think that like a senior kissing a minor would be something that would be exploitative. And that's something that my disgust might be well placed. So should I be exposed to it? And I can imagine other people, saying the same thing, like if there's a consensual horse, an act of bestiality, right? The Torah condemns bestiality. I can imagine someone in 21st century saying bestiality is really not a problem, right? The horse seems to be okay. The woman seems to be okay. They want that, right? And yet, like, is it wrong for me to, to find moral disgust in that. And so those lines of moral disgust are very subjective, partially around exposure and partially around values. And I think that that's a fascinating thing for us to continue to discuss. To your other point around tikkun olam and how the world is broken into pieces and fragmentation, disconnection, the worst plague of all, perhaps, is the ninth plague, the plague of darkness, because it says nobody could see each other anymore. A broken world is where we can no longer see each other, understand each other, feel empathy for each other. Everything, as you said so well, Gary, is broken into pieces. And then you kind of had a segue there into like, should law be the answer to tikkun olam, right? And I think that's a fascinating question, Gary, because I think when many people say tikkun olam, they think advocacy. I am going to advocate for law, right? I think it might even be the primary thing. I mean, there are people who think like go volunteer and like go on a beach and clean up garbage, do some kind of public service act. But I think most people, when they talk about tikkun olam today, mean we're going to advocate legislatively for a more just society. On the one hand, I think that's really important. On the other hand, I think that's very limited. So to give an example where it's very important, we know that the average American donates between like 1%, just above 1%, maybe to 1 to 2% of their income. And we also know that when we reduce taxes, it doesn't correlate with people being more charitable. So someone might say, hey, you know what? Like, let's not legislate taxes. Let's let people be charitable out of the good of their hearts, right? But actually, without those laws of protection, a whole bunch of necessary forms of welfare would never be accounted for just charitably. On the other hand, if you try to just legislate against hate, you try to legislate against anti-Semitism and racism and sexism, blah, blah, blah. Like, is that really going to solve the problem? Hate's gone. We passed the bill in Congress. You can't hate anymore. And it's going to be a felony if you do this form of act of hate. Okay. So, it's actually hate is much more complicated than just that. So we see that tikkun olam is going to require much more. Now, this is my last thing I'll say on this. Nussbaum, in the interview I shared, when she shared that she cares about tikkun olam, the example she immediately went to was dominance. I don't know if she was writing an essay on tikkun olam, if that's what she would say. But in this interview, she said, I'm inspired by tikkun olam. And what that means to me is breaking our sense of dominance over people, over animals, over the land, and having a different relationship than dominance. Now, that's an interesting answer, whether we agree with it or not, that repairing the world is about a fundamentally shifting how we relate to all which is not us. In a transactional or dominant way, but rather in a different type of relationship. So, Gary, you as always, you raise profound questions, and I only scratch the surface in engaging with you. So, hopefully, we'll come back to you after someone else.
Well, I can. I was okay. Waiting to hear from Aglaia because we didn't hear from her last week. We have this void that we're still waiting for Aglaia to fill. So, I'm kind of fascinated by all those because I think of disgust generally in terms of how most people feel about bodily functions and how we hide or push away from it. Because of my professional life, no, bodily functions are human. What the heck? So I was more interested, well, now I'm really interested, I missed the beginning, about the idea of dominance, because as I started thinking about what disgusts me, it's about power over. When I think of particularly human trafficking and that power over dynamic, in whatever form that human trafficking takes, that disgusts me. And I thought about what you quoted from Deuteronomy about the winner taking this bride who was part of the prize of war. And not only what she, the disgust she might feel towards him as she mourns, but also what happens to him over that period of a month as he loses all of those incredible hormones that are flying in the face of triumph when he scoops up this prize. And now, after a month, has to actually face what he's done and how he feels about this prize, much less what his actions meant to his soul, to the world. And will he indeed take her as a bride? Or does she represent something that indeed disgusts him in himself, not because of her beauty or whatever, but just what it means in terms of his own being and the actions he's taken? So those are some of the thoughts that I've had.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, that's a profound reflection upon that dynamic. And I appreciate you bringing our awareness to human trafficking as well. The U.S. Department of State says that at any given time, there's about 27.6 million victims of human trafficking at any given time. And think about those numbers. It's 27.6 million at any given time of people who are literally being moved and controlled and held. It's overwhelming.
Children.
Children, right. Right. Sex slaves or children. And just horrific. And we talk about Tikkun Olam. I mean, if we can only solve that problem, Dayenu, even though there's, you know, countless other problems. Yeah. And how do we raise a next generation globally to not relate to human beings as property, or, you know, that can be controlled and manipulated in such a way? It's a difficult question. Yeah. So thank you. Hi, Aglaya.
Okay, I guess I'll say something today. The author in the book that I actually put in the chat box was actually because of the fact that that was one of the ways that I ended up calling, like, a lot of, you know, well, I ended up basically deciding that I didn't, you know, like, it made me rethink the whole idea of disgust and everything, though. Reading The Civilizing Process, which, you know, I mean, there are some, you know, criticisms of it and everything like that, though. But the idea about how basically people came to this, you know, conclusion, how did you get from a point where, like, during the Middle Ages, you know, you had all kinds of disgusting things going on. I mean, people peeing in public and stuff like that, mm-hmm. versus, like, everybody all of a sudden became, like, all this, all squeamish and everything. Well, if you think about it as something like, okay, this was a process, a fake process that society came to and everything, though, then it starts to seem, but if you just call the fakeness on disgust and everything like that, it kind of does help. However, are we really in a place where we want to call, you know, disgust fake or, you know, anything like that? So just to throw that out there.
Yeah, so interesting. Looking at the historical evolution of what we find disgusting, of what is kept public and what is private, and how that evolves and how our relationship shifts with that. So it's so interesting. I wonder if anybody wants to pick up on that. Yeah, and the fake dimension, as Aglaya points out, as well. So interesting. And yeah, just before Gary, also thinking about politeness and etiquette, you know, just thinking about kind of like what that kind of might mask over as well, even though when there's a value there. Yeah, Gary.
Hello again. I just want to go back to what Sarah was mentioning about dominance. What she talked about is disgusts me too. The thing that has historically always disgusted me was slavery, and I found it interesting historically from a Jewish perspective that even though Jews were allowed to have slaves, but they had to let them go, if I remember, after 7 years. So there was some sense of humanity to slavery, and not the sense that you could dominate this person for their entire life. And if I remember correctly, even if they don't want to go after whatever years of servitude, they were still forced to go out and become free people. And I think that's a great perspective from Judaism, though many Jews in the South prior to the Civil War that had slaves surely didn't let them go. They treated them like property, and that as a Jew to a Jew, to me that's very, very disgusting. I don't know how they could have a Passover Seder and talk about slavery own people. So I that just came to my mind. So I don't know where that fits in anywhere, but it just came to mind.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. And yet, you know, to go, you know, one degree below slavery, but still relevant, is we might think about how people still feel a lack of freedom, a lack of social mobility, a sense of oppression due to economic forces that exist today. People who really feel trapped. If you are a tomato picker who makes $5 an hour and you've been threatened that, you know, you will be reported, maybe deported if you protest against being paid under minimum wage, you know, it's not, it fits some of the technical definitions of slavery, in other ways not, but there's other degrees of that as well, which might not exactly be classified as slavery, but have a level of exploitation in the workforce and economic forces that still exist today and are largely not discussed or looked at in terms of how our global marketplace works, not even to mention America. But yeah, your point there as well is really powerful around Pesach. And with Pesach coming up in just, well, really the end of April, I think we can just think about that as well. Like, we all have our own hypocrisies, but as we sit there at Pesach Seder sermonizing about how we want a more just world, a liberated world, and we can think about, like, wow, it's really kind of absurd that I'm connected to X, Y, and Z in the world, and yet this is still, you know, what we're talking about. And so it's not as obvious as, like, there's a slave serving us our meal, right? Right. But we all have things produced in our home from slave labor. I mean, every one of us has slave labor produced stuff in our home, and that's not the slave in our home. But and so that whole global marketplace itself has that challenge. But yeah, Gary, thanks for sharing that. And it's pretty astounding how many things we can understand and yet still not understand at the same moment. Glea, I think your hand went back up. Hi.
Okay. I was really trying not to talk today, but I can't.
No, we're happy to hear you. Yeah.
Okay, so I can't explain some of the, you know, I mean, I can't explain it in a satisfactory way, and it might not be the way that you want to hear it, though, but explaining things about, well, how can someone have a Passover Seder and own slaves in the 19th century? Okay, just like I said, it's not going to be pleasant, but the idea is that slavery was fundamentally a dehumanizing, you know, system. So if you don't think of someone as fundamentally human the same way you are, then there are a lot of ways that you can make, you know, things like slavery, things like anything, more palatable, just because you dehumanize the, you know, the victim and everything. But then how often do we dehumanize other people? I mean, there are all kinds of ways that we dehumanize people all the time. Sometimes we're just dehumanizing someone because we're not in the best mood or pissed off or, you know, like something, we don't want to hear what they're saying. And so we just, you know, like, basically, though, like, are you necessarily thinking you're the same as me when that happens? Also, the other thing about slavery in the South, though, is that a lot of the time, though, this was your way to move up in society. And so because it's your way of moving up in society, you know, it's there are convenient ways of just twisting your own mind to say, hey, well, this person's not, you know, they're not actually a person, they're sort of kind of a person, but are they really the same kind of person I am? And so, well, I'm technically not doing it to someone who's the same as I am. So, and also I am doing the best thing for them because I am going to be a quote unquote good master versus someone else who is not going to be a bad master. I mean, all kinds of justifications. So I don't know. Like I said, that's the just historian in me coming out, you know, anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Very interesting stuff. Just before we go to Matthew here, I appreciate that, you know, and just to pick up on two little things. One is I want to just problematize a fake word that I like to use, problematize the word dehumanize. On the one hand, I love the word dehumanize because I think it's exactly what happens so consistently that enables atrocities. Is we strip someone of their humanity and that justifies atrocious behavior to them. On the other hand, there's a whole bunch of people who, because someone is human, does not give them a sense of responsibility to them, as if the core problem is making somebody less than human, but if they were only made to be human, they would be deserving of X, Y, and Z. But there's other systems in place that when we see people's full humanity, we're still capable of doing atrocious things to them. And so, I think we have to do some work. While I want to keep intact our opposition to dehumanization, I want to raise the questions of like, what do we need to do in addition to seeing someone as human to actually go to that next level of caring about their dignity? That's the first thing I wanted to share in appreciation of Aglaia's comments. And the second is, yeah, I think these justifications that emerge in systems of exploitation, yes, it's okay. I mean, people have told me this in the back of restaurants. It's okay that I'm paying this person below minimum wage because they're choosing this job. They literally can't get another job. And it's okay if I exploit them because they want it. Now, one of the more complicated areas, there's been a move in progressive thought in the last 10 years on this, is prostitution. There's one camp that says prostitution is evil. It's tragic. It's a man, I mean, not always, but in general, it's a man exploiting a woman. Of course, there's male prostitutes as well. It's a man exploiting a woman and, you know, sex shouldn't be monetized and all blah, blah, blah. It's a moral issue. But there's a progressive camp today that has moved it out of the moral camp. They say, no, this is called being a sex worker, not a prostitute. Don't delegitimize her work. She values her work as a sex worker and we should honor her dignity and legalize this. And allow her to do this because this is what's best for her and it's her choice. Now, that's an interesting debate around what if somebody was willing to enter slavery, so to speak, or willing to enter an exploitative work or willing to be, you know, serve in prostitution. Do we allow or willing as a minor to engage sexually with a senior, right? Do we allow people to make various choices even when we deem it objectively to be exploitative? Or do we say, you know what, like we want to add dignity to sex workers too, because that's their choice and that's how they make their money, this and that. And okay, so anyways, and on the flip side of that, where do we potentially justify something exploitative because we think it's better for the person than any alternative? And I think that that's, you know, quite a complicated issue as well. So, okay, so over to you, Matthew, and I hope, hopefully, Aglaia's, you know, awesome questions will reemerge.
Thank you for your comment about dehumanization and take it away from slavery. Put it in what I'll call the political context now, that we have at least two camps in this country, both of whom dehumanize in a way, the other side. And I'm using it in the sense that the liberals, quote, I cannot believe anyone would support and vote for him in a way that's disdaining or dehumanizing. And some on the other side who are saying, I can't believe you are not supporting him. So there's no community. It was Rabbi Brouse's speech about Amen a couple of weeks ago. When she talked about that dehumanization divide, we have nothing in common in our mind with certain people, and therefore we don't see them. And I just finished reading her book, the Amen book, about how she had a conversation with an Orthodox rabbi, saw her as a greater threat in a sense than Hamas or something like that, because she was a threat from within and is not recognizing. And how do we find the ability to not impose our quote values on someone and listen to them. So I think that's part of humanizing people, is to see them.
Matthew, coming back to you. So I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, let me just say, we have a back door in our house that goes out on a main thoroughfare. And there's a wall, and there's actually a door. The other day, one of my neighbors said to me, by the way, there's a homeless person sleeping in your little alcove. 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, if I'm going for a walk on AJ, that's how I go out. I don't look. And what do? And I waited an hour or two. And I've got motion sensors in the back of your neck, all the stuff. And finally, the person is there. I did not approach or anything. And I actually called the not 911 number, the non-emergency number. Explained the situation. And they said, well, a police officer will come out. Do you want to be talked to? I said, yes. And they came about an hour, and their report to me was there was no cardboard. The person had just been sleeping there for a number of hours. There are, in our community, there's like 15, 18 homes that this happens to on a regular basis because we're on the main thoroughfare. And was I dehumanizing the person? Yes, but it was my personal safety. How do you act in those situations? And the police were very good. They helped the person. It's July and August when it's really hot and it's a shade. It happens. I don't call it in until the afternoon when it's now in the sun. But, you know, you don't want to look at the person. How do you act? I don't know the answer.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for both of those points. I think one is really, really important. You know, that we have our own boundaries, even for those we might wish to protect. We might say, oh, we want to protect the rights of those, you know, experiencing homelessness. But maybe if it's my store, I don't want to let them in. Or maybe it's my backyard, I don't want them to sleep there. So we have our own boundaries, while the problem over there we want to address differently. And I think that that's going to come up a lot in terms of how we think about people's rights and how we think about our responsibilities and the proximity that's involved there. I think many people were all about letting asylum seekers into the country until they got bused to their city. They're like, oh, that's great. Texas, Arizona, I'm all game for that. What? I live in New York City. What's going on here? What are they doing all over here? Right? So it's, and I'm not blaming anyone here, you know, on that. I think that issues change when they get close to us in many ways. It's also true that people might be like, oh, there's a whole bunch of people, that type of person, fill in the blank, whoever that type of person is, who lives in the other side of the city. That's okay. But they're moving in my neighborhood. That feels a little bit different when you start to see those people, you know, in my neighborhood. And so it's a complicated issue. It's very complicated. And here, you know, over here in Scottsdale, there was a hotel that was used for refugees. And people who were oftentimes pro-refugee rights all of a sudden were like, what, in our neighborhood? These people just came from Afghanistan and they're in my neighborhood? They were terrified.
It's like everyone wants workforce housing. Everyone wants new housing, except not in my backyard.
Right.
And
right, exactly.
I believe it's in Chandler now. There's a big development going up. And the developer is building it without changing any zoning. He's building it as a right, so no one can object after 2 years trying to do a better development, more amenities, nicer, and everyone's saying, oh, you're adding 60, you can't do this. And he said, fine, I'll build not as nice a development, but what we don't want, what we want rich, we don't want, we want school teachers only. We don't want other, yeah. And it's NIMBY versus YIMBY, which is yes in my backyard, which is where in California now you can have a casita or an alternate dwelling unit in your backyard without any local zoning approval. It's a state law. They have to allow it. All of a sudden, last year, there were a couple hundred thousand housing units added to rent. And that's happening in Phoenix now, but not Scottsdale. Phoenix, you can do it, but not Scottsdale.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Interesting.
So just how you address homelessness. That's one of the reasons, that's one of the ways to start addressing homelessness.
Interesting.
Is create so, extra housing.
Just to close today on Matthew's first comment, which is kind of political rhetoric, I think that however we choose to engage in this election year, one of the things that we should be very aware of is political rhetoric that's being used, and in particular, rhetoric that is dehumanizing. Whatever stand we take on complex political issues, we ought to be vocal or at least responsive in some way to dehumanizing rhetoric that has oftentimes become all too common. And dehumanizing doesn't simply mean someone stands on the different side of the view than us. It means the particular rhetoric that is used to describe the people that are affected in such situations. So friends, Nussbaum has a lot to offer us, and next week will be our session of this series, 45. Some of you have been at all or virtually all of these, so I'm so appreciative of you being on this journey, and that's going to be with Kwame Appiah, a British Ghanaian gay philosopher at NYU, who has a lot to say. So we'll look forward to exploring that together. And if you are interested in continuing through future series, I hope you will. 10 biggest Jewish ideas we have to offer the world, starting the week right after, same time, same place. Same place as your family room or your car. Have a great day. See you soon.